Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello, and welcome to From Queer to Eternity, a podcast exploring what it means to us to be queer. My name's Scott Hancock, and every episode I'll be chatting to a different guest from the LGBTQ+ community, talking about their lives, experiences, and what queerness means to them, and hopefully discovering just how much we all have in common. Due to the nature of these conversations, certain themes, phrases, or experiences discussed may be upsetting for some of our listeners. But generally, we're here to celebrate queerness in all its forms and have a good time sharing our stories. This episode, I'll be chatting with
Tom Price.
So, hello, Tom.
I just feel like an imposter being on this podcast, Scott.
You're a lovely ally, let's put it that way. You're not here to talk about your queer experiences because...
No.
To my knowledge, you don't have any.
Well, I went to an all-boys boarding school, actually, and I was in love with a boy for about a year, which Ooh. I only talked about publicly for the first time on a sexuality podcast about 6 months ago. So there you are. There's your headline, which no one gives a shit about.
How did that come about?
I was at a boarding school, and I really mustn't reveal any names, but there was just a guy I just felt head over heels in love with. And it's the only time it's ever happened.
Mm.
And I was utterly obsessed with him for maybe not a year, maybe 6 months. And, you know, this is when I was like, God, 14, I reckon. So surging with hormones. Mm. I'm at boarding school. There's no girls anymore because it's an all-boys school. And he was beautiful. I sat next to him in Spanish. He didn't have me. I sat next to him in Spanish, and I was obsessed with him. And and then it just switched off one day. And I know people listening will be like, ha, yeah, you need to think about your sexuality. But it really did. It switched off one day when I was about 16, 17. And it hasn't really, it literally has never come back on since.
Interesting.
There you go. But that's not what I'm here for, Scott.
No.
That's
not
what I'm here for.
You are here today because this is sort of a bonus episode to the series where a few foolish people have gone, oh, it'd be really interesting to hear Scott's story. So I thought, I can't interview myself.
Yeah.
I'll ask the lovely Tom Price. And you, for people who don't know, you are sort of in charge of the Great Big Owl company who host our lovely podcast.
That's right. Yes, I would hesitate to say again in charge. There's a very communist approach. There's five idiots in charge of Great Big Owl. And thank you for bringing this podcast to Great Big Owl because it's done really, really well. And the feedback's been amazing. So let's all just say how wonderful you are, Scott, and how good you are at doing interviews. But really what everyone wants to know is, how good are you at being an interviewee?
I am terrible, as you will very shortly find out.
I doubt that very much. So with that in mind, I think the first question, which you always kick off with, is what does the word queer mean to you?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? If you asked me that question probably about 20 years ago, I would have sucked a lot of air between my teeth like a plumber staring at your old pipes and gone, not sure about that. It's interesting, though, how it's been reclaimed. I'm a lot more comfortable with it now, I think.
Yeah.
But then, you know, 20 years ago, I was late teens. I was just sort of hitting university. So it was all quite new and raw in terms of the feelings. And also, back then, I think the community was a lot more geared towards sexuality, whereas the word queer now feels like it's an umbrella for anyone who basically isn't cishet, a lot more open in terms of gender and sexuality as well. So it's just a nice, big, embracing family. So I quite like it now. I'm sort of...
Yes.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people have changed their approach to it over the years.
It's been a big reclamation, hasn't it, for that word? Because certainly from my point of view, my mum used to use it in the most derogatory terms growing up in small town South Wales. You know, there was a... some old chaps who lived near us who I thought were brothers, because that's what I was told. And one day she told me they were queer. Queer as a coot, that's what she used to say.
Oh, and those coots. Always the queerest of birds.
Thank you for bursting that. That is that the poison, the toxicity of that sentence has echoed in my brain for years. And you just popped it. You've just popped it in a beautiful way. But I still struggle. I mean, it's, you know, nothing to do with me, but I can't say it. Like, for example, I interviewed Jack Guinness the other day, who's written the Queer Bible, and I had to do it. It was on my radio show, and I had to keep saying the Queer Bible, and I found it really, really difficult because I associate it. It was such a word of hate when I was growing up.
I think for a certain generation, it's sort of the equivalent of poof in the 60s or something like that. There's just something quite oddly visceral about it.
You popped on the poof there, love.
Pop on the poof. Oh, audio professional. I'm so sorry. Should we move on?
Yes, I enjoyed you popping on the puff. So you mentioned you were just sort of coming to terms with stuff when you were a teenager. Mm. When did that begin? When did you start to think that you were, oh God, can I say you were different? Is that okay to say you were different?
Or is that
othering you awfully? It probably is, isn't it?
I mean, it probably is. I don't feel that way. I don't know. I always felt a little bit other anyway as a kid because I grew up in Birmingham, where all the strange people go. I grew up in Bourneville, actually, which is basically one big old people's home in South Birmingham, where they make chocolate, but people basically go to retire. So I wasn't really surrounded by a lot of other children. I was really lucky in some ways because I was a smart kid. Mm-hmm. So I did well at school and schools wanted me. I went to a couple of independent schools, both primary and secondary, but we couldn't afford to go there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I sort of had assisted places, something I have to be grateful to Thatcher for.
She did some great things, Scott. She did some great things.
I know. It's annoying. But it was that thing of I felt different growing up anyway because I was surrounded by people who were very well off. My dad walked out on us when I was 11 as well. So
really?
It was, my mum and me and my three siblings. So,
He walked out of four kids.
Yeah, literally, summer holidays, 1996, just got up and walked out. And that, apart from a couple of instances of sort of seeing him on weekends, never saw him again.
Scott.
So there was a lot of stuff going on that made me feel a bit out of place and different from other kids. Mm. And then probably about 13, 14 is when I really started thinking, oh God, I might like guys. In a serious way. I mean, I'd had crushes when I was younger on... I remember being a bit like you, obsessed with one of my teachers at primary school.
Yeah.
Not in a sexual way, but just adoring. And, oh God, this is going to sound so weird. Did you ever watch Stingray? There was something about Troy Tempest. And weirdly, Leonardo from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There was just something about these characters.
Oh my God, I love it. Sexual awakening when when a child through cartoons and the things you see.
And He-Man, obviously, Master of the Universe. You sort of go, blimey.
It's a powerful sense of the someone has pushed the syringe into, you know, you're in the drip and someone's put something in the drip. And I remember it, for me, it was Jennifer Capriati, the tennis player, when I was about, God, 10 or something. And it was just this feeling of who is this ape, this gorilla, this much stronger, bigger personality inside me who's got these urges. And yet mine were all acceptable and accepted in small town South Wales to feel like that, to say I fancy a girl was fine. So I can't even begin to put my brain into what it must have been like for you in that situation.
No, I mean, I do remember around that time trying to show interest in the girls' school next door. Because a bit like you, I went to an all-boys school, but there was, you know, the equivalent right on our doorstep. And at lunchtimes, people would intermingle. And I got on very well with people, but I do remember that. I think there was a girl called Alice who I desperately tried to do the, oh, aren't they smashing? I'd love to do the kissing with you. Oh, and I was just terrible at it. I think because my heart wasn't in it and I wouldn't have known where to start with it, really.
So how many girls did you get off with to really boil this down to?
Do you know, I never have. I mean, I've kissed women. Or rather, at university, I think I had a lesbian friend of mine pounce on me.
Right.
But I've never actually romantically... No, I haven't, actually.
So when was your first kiss?
My first kiss. Oh, wow. It was just then, whatever that noise was.
Someone just came in and said, there you are, Scott. There's your first kiss.
My first kiss actually was much, much later. Again, it's you always forget now that this was in the days pre-internet or smartphones or anything like that. So it was when I was in sixth form at school, and I was quite lucky, actually. I was in Birmingham, which is quite inclusive and multicultural and diverse, and there were some guys in the year above me, upper sixth, this is the kind of school it was, who were quite, you know, just open and flamboyant. And there was a lovely bisexual guy called Dan, who was a lovely sort of big bear of a guy. Not in the sort of gay sense of the word bear, but he was just so big-hearted and lovely. And as I say, he was bi and all the girls loved him, all the guys loved him. And he took me out for my first night on the gay scene in Birmingham.
Oh, wow.
And we went to a place called Route 2, it was called, which, looking back, you sort of go, that's an interesting name for a gay club. But actually, it was more just a gentle bar. But it was quite relaxed and chilled, and a few, you know, a lot of, it attracted the younger crowd. And I went there with a few other schoolmates and a few
How old
of their
were you at this
along.
Point then? Like 16, 17?
I was 17, I think.
Oh my God, imagine now you're sitting in that bar.
I know.
And you see the 17-year-old Scott Hancock.
Oh God,
in.
I mean, I was so, such a square. I was there probably just drinking my Coke because I wasn't allowed to drink anything else. Because I'm such a rule player, it's embarrassing, I think. But yeah, I there was a beautiful sort of slightly gothy guy there around our age as well. Yeah. And I think, actually, no, he wasn't my first kiss. I think it was just that thing of a lot of us were just having fun and talking about kissing and not having been kissed. And so we just have kissed each other.
Yes.
So I don't think there was a specific first person.
So there wasn't like a romantic moment on a bench somewhere?
Oh, no. Right, sadly, okay. Sadly not. I was someone who very much pined after other people in my early days.
That 90s indie way.
It was. I had, basically, my life was played to the soundtrack to Cruel Intentions, I think.
Yeah.
Just Counting Crows and everything else all the way.
Oh, God, Counting Crows. What was that album? Was it Anna and It Forever and After or something like that? Oh, God.
Yeah.
I remember listening to that loads. Okay, all right. So at this point, we're still in Birmingham. You go to university in Birmingham.
Mm.
So when do you escape the Midlands?
Oh, God, I mean, we've leapt right ahead here.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry. Let's go back then. Let's go back to the Midlands, because you're desperate not to leave the Midlands.
No, it's just that thing of you've sort of just leapt to me being an out and proud gay guy rather than...
And there's a lot more to it than that.
Well, I think I had quite a difficult coming out, in a way.
So how old were you? So you go to this gay bar in Birmingham, right? And
by that point, I was you know, I knew who I was and was a bit more comfortable.
Yeah,
I think.
But how far are you at that point away from actually coming out to, for example, your family?
Oh, I'd done that a few years ago. I came out when I was 15.
Oh, okay. That's okay. Right. Is that young? Is that young to come out?
I think it was young at that point, because again, no one really talked about it. I was really lucky at school, actually. As I say, there were other... Everyone was quite accepting about it. I had some brilliant, brilliant teachers.
That's good.
A French teacher called Miss Tudor, who really supported me and, you know, gave me her number and said, if you ever need to talk and stuff, because, you know, it's that thing as well. And a lot of gay people have this, I think, of thinking... And looking back, I have no idea why. I genuinely thought I was going to be kicked out. And
what, of school?
No, by my mum.
Oh, wow.
I thought I'd tell her and she'd just go, I don't want you in the house, get out.
Oh, wow.
So I think I sort of told friends first.
I
told a couple of friends when I was 15. And then I sort of worked my way up to telling my mum.
So telling your friends is like a sort of dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
You're inching closer to the big one. And did they all go okay when you told your friends?
Most of them were cool about it. I mean, it's that thing, it didn't really impact on them one way or another.
Yeah, but still, I remember a guy coming out to me when we were 17, and it was a big deal. This is the late 90s. And I was really shocked. I was just really shocked. It had never occurred to me, even as, you know, I knew gay people existed and I knew that that was a thing, but I just didn't believe there was anyone in my life who could be gay. That's how closed-minded the world I was living in, and I was. So surely some people must have been shocked when you did.
I think some people were. I remember telling my mate Mohit, who really, really great guy, and he was just very... I think he thought I was joking to begin with and went, really? Really? Seriously? And then just was quite cool about it. And he sort of gave me the confidence then to be a bit more open and tell more people.
Yeah.
I made the mistake of thinking that I had to be camp.
Interesting. Interesting.
Which sent me off into a spiral of depression because it wasn't who I was. And I then became desperately unhappy with myself because I didn't like who I felt I had to pretend to be.
Yes.
And that weird sort of catch 22 of going, I'm finally being who I am. And then to manifest that, I felt I had to advertise the fact I was gay.
Right. Right.
And then it was a weird double life of feeling like I was behaving one way at school and one way at home. But yeah, I remember when I decided to tell my mother.
Yeah.
I took the day off school. I felt so sick in my stomach about doing it. I actually couldn't go to school that day. And I woke myself up. And I remember telling her. And her response was, that's nice. Can you put the bins out? And...
This is why you should never come out on a bin day.
No, never come out on the bin day. So I put the bins out. I took the dog for a walk. I think this is so sad. The first living entity I ever came out to was my dog.
Oh.
I wasn't expecting a response, but it was just nice to talk to something or someone. And
they know. They listen. They hear everything.
They did. No judgment. It was lovely.
They're very liberal dogs. Cats. Oh, bigots. Oh. Complete bigots.
I mean, they were hissing me in the street. I knew the cats didn't approve of me.
Tories. So hang on. So
I came out to my mum twice. A week later, I had to double check that she'd heard me.
Interesting. You had to make sure she'd clocked it. And what did she say when you came out second? So the second time you came out to your mum?
Oh, she went, yeah, no, I heard.
Do you think she wasn't surprised then?
No, I don't think she was. It's funny, though, because I look back and my family is so loving and supportive and liberal.
Mm.
I don't know why I ever doubted it. But I think based on, you know, the limited depictions of gay people on television sort of made you think people would always be against you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't tell my grandmother for years and years, and I was terrified of telling my siblings.
Yeah.
Particularly my older brother converted to Islam when he was 18.
God, I thought you were going to say he converted to Islam when you came out to him.
No.
That's a reaction.
But I remember someone at school who was Muslim basically going, you know, you are wrong. You know, you will go to hell, all of that. So because of their reaction, I then became terrified of my brother, who... Mm. They'd sort of led me to believe he would think the same way. And that absolutely wasn't the case because I'm his brother.
But does he not? So there's no conflict with him between what you've told him and what his religion's telling him. There is plenty of room for tolerance and love in his religion as well, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And it's something my brother and I haven't had a direct conversation about, but my mother has related to me in that she's had those conversations with him. And
what does
he's
turned
around to her and gone, well, no, Scott's my brother. That's, you know, he needs to be happy and, you know, I will always love and support him. So it's very easy to pigeonhole religions as being quite fire and fury.
Yes.
But for the most part, that isn't the case at all. Everyone is just about the love. And that's that was nice.
I tell you what's really interesting is this idea that people think, well, coming out in the 90s, it's not the 1950s, for God's sake. And you mentioned, you know, seeing how people coming out has been depicted in fiction, on TV and books and things like that. And what is interesting, if you compare now to then, is that then the gay thing, coming out, anything like that was used as an interruption to the straight world. It was antagonism to the straight world. And whether or not that was done from a point of love to portray gay people as being just like us and doing positive things, it was still always a hand grenade going off in a straight world. Whereas now, things like It's a Sin, which obviously you've talked about on the podcast before, that is just pure celebration of the richness and depth of the gay world. Whereas back then, you still feel like you're coming up against something. You are still, even though you know there's tolerance and love out there, you're still having to raise your head above the trenches.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much of it is a product of growing up during that time or just being a young person discovering themselves and being a bit afraid of themselves, if I'm honest.
Mm.
And, you know, it's that thing of, I remember going into W.H. Smith and staring at copies of Attitude or Gay Times on the top shelf and, you know, desperately wanting to pick one up because I just wanted to learn more.
Mm.
Because I still wasn't really clear on what being gay meant. But it felt like taking your life into your own hands, picking up a copy and taking it to the counter.
Especially because in that sort of world, the woman who or the man who works in Smith's, they're going to tell.
Oh,
everybody.
I thought they were going to scream across the shop. You know, we've got a whoopsie. You know, I thought everyone was going to turn around. I mean,
it's like in Ghostbusters, we got one.
Absolutely, and it's such a sort of ridiculous, irrational fear. But everything felt so risky. I mean,
yeah.
As I say, about that time, we only just had dial-up. But I wouldn't dare search for, you know, porn or anything because you'd be, I mean, occasionally your browser would redirect you to something and you just go, oh my God, take it off the screen. I'm, you know, you'd be terrified that someone would make the link.
Yeah.
I think the closest I came to, you know, searching for porn was looking at, you know, thumbnails of the Adam Rickett calendar online.
That is a difficult wank.
Back in the day. Oh God, I mean... I'm not the only person, I know, having had conversations, I'm not the only person to have experienced this, but my sexual awakening was pretty much to the Argos catalogue and the gym section, because it's the only place you could get access to photos of, you know, reasonably buff, topless men.
Yeah. We didn't realise the
That is awful, I shouldn't say that, but...
No, you must, you absolutely must. It's important, the world needs to know that Scott Hancock likes to pleasure himself to the Argos catalogue. Let's not even put it in past tense, to make it present tense. We had...
Only the crockery section, Tom.
Fair enough. Ooh, look at that china.
Bit of Wedgwood.
I've got Wedgwood. We had, you know, we were on the brink of the... and this is a phrase that will take us back, the information superhighway.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, there you go. At the www dots. And it was all about to explode. And we had no idea what was about to happen and how easily we could access stuff and information and facts and all these things. So I don't know what my question is really. Do you think that that has therefore made it so much? Is this a podcast where you're just going to say, God, it must be so easy to come out these days? Because it's still hard. But, and yet, with all that access to not only information, other communities, other people like you, you're completely isolated at this point.
I mean, I don't know if it is easier to come out because I think there's still a sense growing up that, I don't know, a queer life is somehow an unconventional life.
Mm.
And it's interesting, I was having a conversation with someone the other day, a lovely straight mate of mine, who was going, you know, perfectly positively going, you know, if people have specific pronouns or want me to address them in a certain way, I absolutely will. But I just don't see the importance of labels, you know, why we need to address that.
And I was sort because of, labels have been made for you. That's why you don't mind labels, because they fit you.
It's that thing of, you know, we live in a world where people are going, oh, we shouldn't have labels. But I'm sort of trying to say, you know, when you're in a world where you have had to question yourself and, you know, really examine yourself and, you know, there are a lot of gay people who don't want to be gay growing up because it will make their life a lot harder. And that's certainly how I felt. So actually, by the time you come out the other side and go, do you know what? Yeah, I've accepted this is who I am. And other people who don't want to accept it are going to have to accept it as well. Those labels are important. Even if they sort of put you in a narrow bracket, you sort of go, no, I need to claim this because this is important to me.
Anything that helps you eradicate the tiny increments of shame that must build up at that moment. And, you know, for every single opportunity to reach out and find someone else out there like you, you have slightly less shame. You don't feel so alone. So did you feel shame when you were coming out? Or did you feel like...
Oh, God. Coming out always felt like an apology.
God.
And sometimes it still does. You know, depending on who you're with, it can be... in a work environment, or it can just be in a taxi with a driver who makes the wrong assumption or something like that.
Have you had those experiences?
Oh, well, always. You know, even something as simple as going to the doctor and, you know, they just make an assumption, talk about your girlfriend or something like that, and you just sort of go, actually, and it just feels so awkward. And sometimes you go, should I correct this? Is it worth it? Is it relevant? And yeah, it's not, I can't imagine there's a straight equivalent.
Is there a straight equivalent? No, because the world has been built for us. And we just sort of, you know, all I was imagining when you described that thing at the doctor is the all-encompassing way. I guess they're called micro aggressions is the wrong word in the case of the doctor. That's not a doctor being aggressive, that's just thoughtlessness. But just the assumptions that cover every single element of life are that you are heterosexual. We are still in that place now in 2021. That is the default assumption, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I do it with people as well. Even lovely Lou Caulfield, who we had on the podcast a few weeks back, when I first knew her, I just assumed she was straight, even though obviously she is the most flamboyant, out and proud, you know, queer person you could meet. You just sort of go,
she's with a guy for years.
Well, but you know, you sort of go, oh, I don't want to make assumptions. And that's coming from me, where I'm sort of, I don't know, it's interesting.
But it's the tiny changes in language now. I'll always say, how's your other half? Who, do you have another half? Like, it's just, it's so easy to do. And it avoids anyone having to, oh, you know, because as soon as you're having to correct someone, actually, well, no, even if it's the nicest, say, in this case, doctor in the world, it still makes you feel awkward.
It makes you feel defensive. It makes you feel like you have to justify your life choices.
Correct a stranger. Yeah, it's exactly.
I don't say life choices even. It's not a choice. But, you know, it makes you feel, as I say, it's apologetic. You sort of don't want to make it. So equally, I know some people who aren't apologetic and are very sort of forthright. And again, that's awkward. I'm just not a very awkward. I mean, I'm an extremely awkward person, Tom. You know that. But I don't like additional awkwardness if I can help it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've come out to your mum twice, right?
Yes.
You come out to her a third time, or did you leave
third
it at
time
two?
Lucky. Maybe I should.
This could be a good next episode of the podcast.
I'll give you an update next series. Yeah.
Oh, hello you. My name's Tom Price.
Hello, I'm Dave Cribb.
You should come and join us. Every day we do a podcast called Cabin Fever, where we talk to loads of comedians who've had to cancel everything else in their lives, so they come on our podcast instead, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, it's an isolation podcast.
Dave, were you yawning at the start of that sentence then? Was it just a little yawn?
Yeah, it's basically the Great Big Owl isolation podcast. We'll have people on from all our podcasts, from your Rule of Threes, your Brian and Rogers, your Musicals, your Bitchins. If you like any of our podcasts, if you like any of those people, chances are they'll be logging onto the Zoom call and just chatting, because let's face it, they got nothing else to do.
Also, there'll be a quiz on the bill. All right, see you soon. Lots of love.
Cabin FE83709. Oh, that's our Twitter.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
name.
So at what point are we at, please, if we go back to that? What year are we at now? Whereabouts are we in the Scott Hancock life?
So I've come out to mum probably 15, 16.
Right. Okay.
Come out to people at school. It's all good. Mm-hmm. Been to my first gay bar. That's exciting. Mm. Remember the goth kid from Walsall, Walsall seems so exotic at the time. You know, so far away. You'd have to get a completely different train.
Oh, the journey you were to go on and your coming out adventure all the way to Walsall. Being honest, I'm not... It sounds like awkwardness and difficulty, but it doesn't sound like any sort of tremendously painful moments so far. This all sounds like it's been okay. Am I heteroglossing this?
No, I mean, if I am being absolutely honest, there was a period of about a year and a half where I was on antidepressants and I had quite a troubled 18 months. But I think a lot of that was partly to do with stuff, you know, fallout from my dad. And things going on, sort of still processing that, actually. But also, as I said, I came out completely the wrong way. I told people but then behaved in a way I felt I had to, rather than just being who I was.
That's interesting, the thing you were saying about you overcompensated and switched on this sort of camp version, because you didn't know what your identity was. You didn't know what the gay identity
was. No,
that was
the only sort of queer stuff. That was the only sort of idea I had of gay people was, you know, stuff like Gimme, 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 or Will and Grace, or John Inman, and Kenneth Williams, and you're sort of going, oh, well, you know, if that's what you have to do. It's such a stupid thing to think, looking
back.
Because
that's a gay identity that's been presented by a heterosexual world, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, do you know what really changed it, I think, in my head?
John Barrowman.
No, but I do actually have a story about John from long before I ever met him. But no, what changed it in my head was Casualty.
Oh, yeah.
And I think in the late 90s, maybe, or early 2000s, actually, it must have been very early 2000s, there was a character called Sam, I think, in Casualty, played by Jonathan Kerrigan, who was a gay character, but he wasn't particularly camp. I mean, they gave him bleach blonde hair, just so you had to know he was the gay character.
Sort of follicle tabard.
But,
right, okay. But
yeah, you know, he was very down to earth, and he just felt a lot more sort of grounded. And that was quite useful, you know, because it was primetime telly. You could watch that without, you know, it wasn't like watching Queer as Folk where you had to stay up late and watch it with the volume turned down in case anyone knew you were watching the gay stuff. You could watch Casualty and, you know, you weren't obviously watching it because you had the gay character in it. So
yes.
I think
it's interesting, isn't it?
Quite important, yeah.
And the BBC has, with shows like that, and for my memory of that was Colin in EastEnders, played by Michael Cashman, who was just, like everything you were saying about this guy in Casualty. He was not the stereotypical Michael Inman, loud, exuberant, flamboyant, being honest, comedy character. That's how they were presented.
Well, that's it. It was almost on screen in theatre that, you know, they were acceptable because they made you laugh.
Yes.
Rather than being fully rounded human beings. And that was what was quite nice about the Sam character in Casualty was, you know, he had a job. You know, he had a life. He wasn't just there as comic relief.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that I think took the pressure off me to behave in a particular way.
They were so important, those sort of... They come across as quite humdrum, by-the-by characters. Colin in EastEnders is a very boring character. That's the point.
Oh, but you've met me. I'm a very boring gay. So, you know, we're out there.
Well, this is the point, though, that it was a choice of the writers of EastEnders to make a character who was gay, but ultimately quite dull. Because there was a responsibility to show people that is the thing. That is the type of gay person.
Yeah, God, there was a period where, you know, it felt like every gay person you saw on TV was contracting AIDS or,
yeah,
you know,
God.
Just sort of went, oh, God, is that... I mean, genuinely sort of thought, oh, is this the world I'm walking into?
Yeah, so the late 90s, the terror of HIV and AIDS was still very much there. It was there for me as a straight guy going off to university. So how was that for you at that point?
This is the thing. At school, everyone sort of treated being gay like, you know, you had a disease, because that's what the media had sort of made homosexuality become. Even in, you know, sex education classes. Oh, God, it would be so awkward, because teachers would take me aside at the end and go, well, look, I know this doesn't apply to you, but just imagine that everything we've talked about, you apply to being with a man. And, you know, they were clearly trying their best to acknowledge something needed addressing specific to the homosexual experience, but couldn't find the way. You know, they didn't have the language yet. They, you know, it was still Section 28 where, you know, they were trying their best, but actually it just became quite awkward. But yeah, it was, there was still that stigma attached to being gay.
It's just so, it's just...
I mean, when I came out, the age of consent was still 18 for gay men, when it was, you know, 16 right. for everybody else, which again makes you feel very different. And you're sort of going, okay, there's clearly something wrong with me.
This is what I mean about the, and I do want a better phrase, about the microaggressions that sit across society, this web, this invisible net that has got you in everything, all these tiny little things, all the signs, every signal you read as a you know, vulnerable sponge absorbing society when you're just trying to work out your own personal makeup. Everything out in society is saying wrong. No. It's either saying that's wrong or it's silence.
No, I remember my first proper gay experience was, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but it was
well, that's what this podcast was for.
I'm so
for
sorry,
sakes, God.
But it was I met someone on gaydar, and they were a medical student at Birmingham University, and by this point I was 18, and you know, we had a few messages. We phoned each other up on the landline because we didn't have mobile phones. never have you rushed to get a phone faster. And he was sort of, even though, you know, age of consent and everything like that, he was sort of going, oh, God, please don't tell anyone I'm you know, meeting with an 18-year-old or it could end my career. And you go, he was, what, 20, 21?
He means that as well. That's not just levity.
No, he was genuinely concerned that it would look like he was cradle snatching or something. Yeah, and that was a bit weird.
So even your first experience has got just an edge to it, an edge to it of this is wrong.
Yeah, we never messaged each other again.
I mean, he was a doctor, so you only felt a little prick, I suppose.
Do we leave that bit in? I don't know.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, I'm really hoping you're going to cut around all of the things where I say completely inappropriate sentences, Scott, just to protect my very precious reputation.
But yeah, he was genuinely afraid that even though there was only a 3-year age gap and we were both legal, that it would somehow impact on his career in a negative way as a doctor. Which is mad.
Mad. I mean, imagine if that was a man sleeping with an 18-year-old girl, 21-year-old boy sleeping with an 18-year-old girl. He'd be lauded, celebrated, advanced an extra year in his medical career.
Oh, yes.
But he would, wouldn't he? This is the thing.
It's odd. There's a much bigger conversation about how, you know, boys are raised at school to almost, I don't want to say sexualize women, but there is a, certainly where I was, and it was an all-boys school, but there was a lot of almost competitive talk about, you know, getting girlfriends and everything like that. Maybe that's the same across the board. I don't know. But
locker room talk, mate. Locker room talk.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's particularly healthy. But of course, I never had that because no one was really going to listen to me go, oh, have you seen the Argos catalogue this season? Oh.
So when did you find yourself feeling like you had a safe space, a sense of community, some friends who were like you, and you started to feel like you were at home in the world and you felt happy in your own skin?
Oh, it was university. You know, because I at school you're sort of forced to be with the people you're with, and you know, I was with a lot of lovely people, but as I say, because I was from a not well-off background, but surrounded by people who could afford to be at the school, we didn't have anything in common, and I couldn't really spend time with them because I just couldn't afford to. But at university, I was surrounded by like-minded people because we were on the same course and they were good people. And also, I went to Birmingham University, and there was an LGB association, as it was then. Because, you know, gender didn't really come into it. It was all focused on sexuality. And it was so funny. There was just basically a little room at the top of the student union, right at the top in the sort of rafters. So you'd have to go up all the stairs, basically out of the way. And you'd walk in, and there was basically a bucket of lube and condoms and dental dams just by the door.
What's a dental dam?
It's basically almost like a sheet of latex.
Oh, yes, I saw that. I remember seeing those. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
But basically, it was sort of, you know, a provision for people to practice safe sex. So you get a lot of people just popping their head around the door, grabbing a handful and then buggering off. But you'd also get a lot of people who just hang out there between lectures. And that was literally a safe space. And actually, I ended up getting quite involved in that. I ended up on their committee.
Yes.
And it went from LGB to LGBT while I was there, just opening it up. I mean, this was about 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
So we were just starting to see that introduced into the conversation.
Yeah.
But just the people I met there, and also the people on my course. And then I started doing amateur dramatic stuff as well. So met a few people on that. And it just started feeling like I could be myself and people wouldn't judge me. And people liked me for who I was rather than me pretending to be someone else.
So at this point, the overcamp thing that you went through, that phase is gone.
Oh, that had sort of died out during my A-levels.
Okay, right.
But university was definitely a chance to just shake the Etch-a-Sketch and, you know, start afresh.
But joining the committee as well, I mean, trust you to find some, you know, an opportunity to get some good admin out of sexuality. Yeah, no, why not?
If I can do paperwork.
Yeah, right. But in a serious note, did you find yourself thinking, I want to get involved in helping, in campaigning, in being part of this community and not just a recipient of help, but I want to proactively do things to help other people?
I think I did. I mean, I think I wanted to. When I joined, you know, you'd be there during Freshers Week and it would all be geared towards pub crawls and clubbing and stuff like that. And I'd sort of be the one going, yeah, this is lovely, but, you know, not everyone's up for this. Maybe we could do some pool nights or, you know, book groups or stuff like that. So it was just sort of recognizing that not everyone in the community did want to just go out and get smashed and shag around, and that's a generalisation, but actually at university it sort of was.
But that's interesting, is that the idea sounds like when you talk about the bucket, you know, the bucket of lube and condoms and things like that by the door, there's this thing where, well, there's the LGB, what would it have been then? The LGB?
It was the LGB Association, yeah.
It was called the society when I was at university, it was called Lesbigay. That was there.
Oh.
That was it, wasn't it? Lesbigay. And
as in let's be.
Let's begin. Yeah, let's begin. And it seems like, well, that society, as it was, you know, you join all societies when you join university, that was synonymous with safe sex. That's basically what it's for. This society isn't actually about sexuality. It's about fucking. It's not like I joined, you know, what did I join? The drama society as soon as I got to university. It's not like we sat down for our first meeting and they went, right, so fucking. do you know what I mean? Why is that the top? Why has that been historically the top of the list?
But that, it's... I think, again, though, it's people coming to university. And at that point, as I say, we didn't have the internet or anything like that. A lot of people didn't really understand necessarily what safe gay sex entailed. So, you know, as you say, there'd be people staring at a dental dam going, what's this for? And you'd sort of explain it and they go, oh, God, that never would have occurred to me.
Yeah.
But as I say, just in the years I was there, it went from LGB to LGBT. So it became... It slowly stopped becoming just about sex and sexuality, but more about the community and the politics. Hilarious story. You'll love this as well from my university days. I fell head over heels with someone from my amateur dramatics group.
Excellent.
As you do. And they were very, very sweet. And we got on like a house on fire, you know. Still friends to this day, but... He didn't want to pursue anything because he was saving himself for his favourite musical theatre star, John Barrowman. Which I'm sure you will appreciate the irony of this, given how I have ended up working with John so much in my professional life in recent years.
Have you told John about this?
I have told John about this. That basically, he was blocking me about a decade before we ever started working together. But
John must love that.
Yeah, just absolutely.
Oh my God, I've been in control of your life for years, Scotty.
Oh God. I mean, looking back, there was so much weird sort of adolescent young male turmoil and the drama of relationships was hilarious.
Yeah, of course. So much fun. I miss all that. Now we're all boring and middle-aged.
Mm.
So where do you now you are sitting in boring middle-aged land. I mean, you're not really because you're still young. But now you are approaching boring middle-aged, which for me is the best bit. I'm thrilled to be boring.
Oh, I love a sit-down wee.
Oh, I love a sit-down wee. You can't go wrong. You cannot go wrong. You
literally can't go wrong.
Well, exactly. That's why. That's why my wife has been encouraging me to do them for years. So now you sit there and we can now sort of, you know, we can be the old guys on the bench looking at all those young crazy things dancing in the park. What advice and what words of wisdom do you feel you would give off, maybe to yourself watching yourself walk into that club in Birmingham back in the day, or to people who are beginning that journey themselves now in the newer, you know, landscape where the conversation has moved on so much in the last 20 years, brilliantly in so many ways?
Do you know, I think the thing I take away now is just letting stuff happen, just relaxing a lot more. I was going to share the story of my first relationship, which was basically a bit EastEnders.
Oh, yeah. Did someone die at Christmas?
No, not quite. But
oh, God.
It was my coming up to my 21st birthday, and I had a really, really good mate who was straight and I adored. And I sort of confessed to him that I was struggling being friends because I felt a little bit more. And he was so good with that information and went, do you know what? It's cool. Don't worry about it. And that made me relax a lot more. But then we were all going away, a group of us, for my 21st. And then a few days before, he said, do you know what? I think I might feel the same way. And we went, don't worry, we'll talk about it when we're away. And we basically went to a desolate Norfolk beach.
Oh, my God, this is like the start of Peter's Friends. Oh, my God.
But it was November, so it was a sort of bleak, wintry beach. And it was hilarious, actually, because there were four of us, me and a mate of mine. We were the two gayers. And we were with two ostensibly straight people who then both turned out to be gay as well.
Wow.
But me and my then-to-become boyfriend had a chat the one night, had a bit of a kiss, which was lovely. And then the next day, we're going for a long walk along the beach, and we said to the others, we're just going to go for a wander. We'll be back in about 20 minutes or so. And we just walked down the beach and, you know, chatting really nicely. And then let's just had a bit of snoggage, all very nice. Mm-hmm. On the cliffs directly above us, our friends just happened to take a walk as well and see us. And my gay friend at that point was also shamelessly in love, unrequited, with my straight friend.
Oh, my God.
And he was the one driving us everywhere. And
this is a love quadrangle. I love it.
Oh, it was awful. It was the most awkward, awkward. I say we laugh about it now. I laugh about it. All the others give me a frosty stare and like to pretend it never, ever happened. But I find it too funny to not talk about. But it's that thing of, I think because of how we were discovered, in a way, we then felt obliged to leap into something and make it work. And, you know, there was a lot of affection and love in that friendship. And indeed, the subsequent relationship. But I think the pressure of having to justify the fallout from that weekend made it quite tempestuous at points.
We've thrown a hand grenade into this group, so now we have to power on through. Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of situations a bit like that, maybe not quite as soap opera, but where people feel they, you know, they might say something to someone or something, and then they feel compelled to make something work, even if they're not feeling it. And as I say, that relationship was lovely. Probably tried to make it last longer than it should have. Because it was the first relationship as well, and you know, first relationships you think are never going to end.
Do you feel that when you have a successful long relationship, do you feel, how can I phrase this without being offensive?
Let's have a listen. Let's have a little go at this. Because of the prevailing stereotype that gay people, gay men, have short relationships, are having sex with lots and lots of people because of this stereotype. Is it therefore more precious when you are proving to the world that you are monogamous? That's what you want to do. Those are your choices. Therefore, to give up on that relationship feels somehow like you're giving up on that image of yourself. Is that, have I been offensive at any point?
I mean, I'm not offended.
Okay, all right,
I don't think so either, because I've always been quite private. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, everyone in my office was so bored of the drama of my relationship at that point. But I never felt like I was representing gay men.
No.
In that sense. But it's that thing of, you know, much, much later, because after that, I was single pretty much throughout my 20s.
Wow.
And I went on a few dates, and I sort of by that point didn't feel the pressure. So it's like I met my old housemate was the best person to live with. And I met him sort of by going on a date. And it was that thing of just clicking with someone, but not in a romantic sense.
Yeah.
And just going, do you know what? We really like each other's company. And that was lovely.
Chemistry doesn't have to be romantic.
Well, that's it. And I think, again, a lot of people assume that if two gay men meet or get along, oh, they must be fucking. And you go, no, really. We're complex human beings as well. But, you know, it's that thing as well with my other half. There was never any pressure there when I met him about 7 years ago. Because actually, we had mutual friends and just happened to cross paths on Twitter and suggest we go for a coffee. And as far as I knew, he was straight. He thought I was straight. So it was just two people meeting for coffee, getting on really well, clicking. And, yeah, the rest is history. Really?
Listen, Scott, I've got to go because I've got to go and get the children from school.
Yes.
My question to you before we finish this. First of all, thank you so much for appearing on your own podcast. It's really good of you.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me once I forced you into it.
I hope I've done you justice. I really enjoyed this. What I want to know is, from Queer to Eternity Series 2, that is going to happen. Who do you want to get on it, please?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to say, because I do actually have a list. I do have a list of people. And,
of course,
you know,
you do. Admin, always the admin, on the committee.
The spreadsheet. I just quite like the mix of people we've had in Series 1.
Yes.
And I think we might even have a special from the London Podcast Festival, maybe.
Yes.
We need to discuss that.
That's happening. That is happening. Yeah. This is yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, who knows? But
all right, good. You've swerved that answer. Well done.
There you
right.
go. Fine. Well, you've got to get the kids, so, you know.
I do. I have to go get the bloody children. Scott, thank you for flipping the roles on From Queer to Eternity.
I would only do it with you, Tom. Thank you.
Good. I knew you would.
Bless you.
Massive thanks to Tom for agreeing to turn the tables on me for this episode and for introducing the podcast into the Great Big Owl family. As this is our last episode for a while, I'd like to thank all our contributors for this first series. Nathaniel Curtis, Leander Natty Lewis-Nyau, Jamie Windust, Hannah Raymond Cox, Misha Butler, Emily Garside, Daniel Brocklebank, Samantha Bayard, Paul Clayton, Alexandra Desar and Lou Caulfield, Samuel Barnett and Thea Cochran. If you've heard any names you've missed out on, go and investigate now. If you've heard them all, leave us a rating or review wherever you hear your podcasts. You're probably already following us on social media, but if not, we're at Queer to Eternity on Twitter and Instagram. And as Tom said, we'll be back with a special episode later in the year, and hopefully very more soon. Until then, stay safe, stay happy, and thanks again for listening.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Richard and Greta, gonna make your lives better today.
If you'll subscribe to our podcast.
You know, it's all about how to get the most out of your partner.
And we're partners.
So we know all about it.
It's good. Get it wherever you want to get it, when you go and get it from your podcast, please. Richard and Greta.
You know?
You know?
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment.
Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.